ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Great show lined up this week. As always, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. So this topic of ESG investing keeps coming up. ESG stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. This is also referred to as socially responsible investing. Quite simply, the idea is to align your investments with your social beliefs. Own companies you believe are, quote unquote, doing the right things, and avoid companies you don't believe in or disagree with. So for example, some investors don't want to own gun manufacturers. They have extremely strong views on guns. And so what we're seeing is the proliferation of ETFs that allow you to express views like this. And while this seems relatively straightforward, there's actually a lot of debate right now surrounding ESG investing. It's more complicated than appears at first glance because there are questions like, are you really making any difference by avoiding something like gun stocks? Do gun companies even care? There are also questions about returns. Are you sacrificing returns by investing in ESG? Maybe you're better off just donating money to a particular cause to better move the needle. We're going to get into all of this today, and we have two excellent guests. We're going to start with ETF.com's Drew Voris, who recently wrote a fantastic piece on Facebook and their exclusion from ESG ETFs because of their data privacy issues. And I think this paints a really good example of how you might think about ESG investing overall. So we'll look at that, and then we'll also have Drew give us a quick update on the ESG ETF landscape. We'll then be joined by Ryan Curlin, head of capital markets at Alpha Architect. They're a boutique ETF issuer. They have some really interesting value and momentum ETFs, but Ryan has some strong views around ESG investing. I think really questioning whether it's worthwhile. And you may recall we had Ryan on the podcast last year to discuss his mission to kill the term smart beta. He feels like it's really just a marketing label. Jason, I think Ryan's views on ESG are similar, which really cuts to the heart of the ESG debate, right? Is this marketing or is this substance?
I think by necessity, it has to be a little bit of both. From a marketing standpoint, particularly in the ETF space, remember, ETF providers don't pay advisors to sell their products. So how do you get your message out? How do fund companies let investors become aware of something that is out there? So there, I think by necessity, there's going to be some marketing to that. But on the other side, is it meaningful? Well, I think just by default, if a fund company comes out with a completely irrelevant product, it's going to go away. It'll hit the dustbin of history. So it has to be meaningful as well. So I think somewhere in the middle, so I think people have sort of staked out some sides, you know, some are far left, some are far right, not to borrow the political reference, but there has to be a little bit of both. I think there are also some people that don't even know about the other side. They simply, I want to, you know, fulfill my gun ownership, you know, desires, or the environment, those sort of things. And there's some other people that just buy the hottest headline. So that's always going to be there. But I think there has to be a little bit of both.
By the way, I'm sure we'll cover this with Drew, but the two biggest ETF launches so far this year are both ESG ETFs. I guess further adding fuel to this debate. So again, I know we've covered this topic quite a bit. I just think, like smart beta, this isn't going away. And so hopefully we can add something to this conversation, just give everyone some food for thought. I also have some great clips from SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce. She gave a speech on ESG a few weeks ago. I'll play those in a bit, but she completely eviscerated ESG in investing. All right, in addition to this topic of ESG, we're also going to hit Ryan with some rapid-fire ETF questions. And then later, John Reese, co-founder and CEO of Validia Capital Management, is going to spotlight the Validia Market Legends ETF, which this is really interesting. It attempts to replicate the strategies of investors like Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham and Peter Lynch. Validia has built models based on the strategies of various legendary investors. So we'll get into all the details of that as well. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find us on Twitter at etfprime. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, we would greatly appreciate if you could drop us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. All right, let's start this week with ETF.com's Drew Voris.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Drew, just to set the table here, I don't think you and I have ever discussed this before. I'm curious where you fall on this whole topic of ESG. Do you think investors should be considering things like a company's environmental track record or diversity, or do you think there are better ways for investors to enact change? Or I guess, is it both?
Well, first of all, I hate the term ESG as much as Ryan does smart beta, because it's not a blanket term. Environmental, social, and governance are three very different issues in some ways, and we'll get to that with Facebook. So one, I think that's confusing. Two, I don't think it's reaching the mass audience out there because the term just doesn't make sense to people initially. An S&P 500 fund, people understand immediately what that is. You start getting into ESG, and it's you know, once you start confusing an investor, they kind of close up. Socially responsible and ESG are sort of the same things in my eyes. And I'm right in the middle, I guess. For one, I think it's cool that we're probably getting new investors into the market that are motivated by these kinds of products. They want their money going to at least some perceived good in their eyes, and they're involved in their investment, and I think that's great. On the other hand, again, there's a lot of confusion of what this actually is, and just saying a fund is ESG doesn't mean it's sufficed all those requirements for environmental, social, and governance. So I think in that regard, it confuses investors, and that's never good. But however, above all that, the whole sense of these environmental, social, and governance criteria are being pushed into the board of directors of big companies by big asset managers, including BlackRock. Larry Fink has been a big advocate of boards of directors following these principles, as has State Street. So we're seeing large asset managers taking it to the boards of directors, and of course, that can only be a good thing. So I think in that respect, there is some good, there's some bad, and I think it's really up to the investor to decide and understand what they're doing. And I think most ESG investors understand more what they're getting than the common mutual fund investor.
You mentioned the word confusion. Do you think that education can help here, or do you think it's just really difficult to take everybody's wishes and desires and how they view about different societal issues and try to wrap those into a single package? Or again, yeah, is it both?
I think that's really hard to do. But I think, you know, it's something that's just going to be there. It's a tool. I don't think you're going to see ESG overtake, you know, major parts of the ETF market. Right now, roughly $40 billion in social responsible ESG products in a $4 trillion market. So I think it'll be just something on the menu for investors, and whether or not that's the right thing to do, that's something Ryan certainly will be speaking to. But I think the idea that the marketing side of it isn't working, because I don't think people understand what ESG is. I think they understand the environmental part, If you said these were environmental ETFs, which we've seen before, wind power, clean energy, people get that. Whether they want it or not, it's up to them. But when you start getting into some of these other areas, which we'll talk about, I don't think it's clear to most investors, especially retail.
Let's talk a little bit more about the ESG ETF landscape. Give us some highlights here. What stood out to you?
Well, you touched on it. For one, we saw two big launches come in from iShares and DWS, both over $1 billion right now over the last few months. Obviously, that came in with some money, as Eric Balkunas, as we always talk about, BYOA, some bring-your-own-assets came into those. And that represented almost half of what we saw in new flows into the ESG funds, which were about $5 billion. Not bad. I mean, as I said, it's around a $40 billion space in the market, so 10% growth halfway through the year. But again, those are two outliers, so it wasn't a spattering of ESG that, you know, raised it half or raised $5 billion. It was really two funds. And then we also had Vanguard had some two new funds as well come along recently. So there is getting more attention to it. But in terms of growth, it's going to be a steady climb up the hill. I mean, it's still a long ways to go in terms of really capturing some incredible market share.
Drew, you mentioned the Vanguard ETF. So the two ESG ETFs they launched were ESGV and VSGX. Those launched, I believe, in September of last year. And we talked on the podcast about how perhaps those could be a litmus test for whether ESG ETFs could succeed. And I think the thought was that if Vanguard couldn't have success here, that would be pretty telling. Now, since their launch, they're approaching $1 billion in assets combined. And obviously, a billion is a lot, but this is also Vanguard we're talking about. So do you think ESG has sort of passed the test here?
Sure. I mean, it's Vanguard has a way of distributing their products, educating, and that's, you know, $1 billion is not too bad. And once, you know, the more it's out there, the more investors, especially in the Vanguard circle, will see this and probably become more educated. And again, it's a choice. If an investor wants to do it, great. If they rather stay where they're at, sit in their S&P 500 fund because they feel more comfortable in that, that's great too. I would also point out too that overall, in terms of Vanguard, we have something on our site that rates ESG ETFs from MSCI ratings. And the ratings work just like in the bond market, AAA, BBB, et cetera. So you can actually look at different types of ESG funds and see how MSCI is rating them in terms of meeting these goals. Just saying you're an ESG ETF doesn't necessarily make you, you know, a pure ESG fund like you had referred to, Nate.
Drew, on those MSCI ratings, is that just if you go to the ETF page, so ETF.com/SPY, and then that rating will be on that page?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's talk more about this piece you wrote. It was titled Facebook Faces ESG Index Music. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a great way for investors to wrap their head around ESG investing. And you walk through how, at first glance, Facebook would seem to be a good fit for ESG. So the company has a lower impact on the environment than other companies. Social is obviously core to their mission, right? Connecting people around the world. But of course, they've had these data privacy issues. And so that's kept them out of some prominent ESG ETFs. Do you maybe want to talk about Facebook's ESG rating in more detail and then how this ties into ESG ETFs?
Sure. And just to preface this, some of this is my opinion. Okay, this was a blog. The point I was trying to make is that everybody's familiar with Facebook and the data breaches and some of the compromise of customer data that has happened. But I don't think when people hear that, they're like, oh, that's going to hurt Facebook's governance ranking and ESG. You don't really make that connection. And as you said, most tech companies are very high rated when it comes to environmental rankings in terms of ESG. Social isn't quite just bringing people together. In fact, Facebook got dinged in this area for its transparency of its corporate policies. So they were selling data, as you recall, to Cambridge Analytics, which is a big controversy. That was never made public in internal circles as well as it should have been. So that brought them down in some ways. But the real kicker was governance. And governance means a company is doing what's best for its shareholders, its employees, and most importantly, its customers. And here, with the repeated data breaches, selling a private data, personal data that users weren't aware of, they really let down their customers repeatedly. And I also pointed out, and we haven't seen it yet, but there have been reports that the FTC is about to settle with Facebook for a record $5 billion over a 2011 FTC agreement that they violated, as well as these repeated data breaches that not necessarily they're a victim of. Some ways they were allowing third-party apps to come in and access data, so they weren't necessarily handing it to people. So there's been this repeated breach of customer data and customer personal privacy, and the FTC is also going to lay down some new ground rules for Facebook. So that's been brewing for a while. And as I also mentioned, last month, S&P ESG index from S&P Global, they dropped Facebook from their index. And it's a fairly new index. It started at the beginning of the year, and at the time, when it, on inception, Facebook was 2.5% of the index. So to go from 2.5% in the ESG index to nothing is a pretty big turn of events.
And Drew, Facebook is not in either of the two largest ESG ETFs now, correct?
That is correct. And those are the two that just launched. That's iShares ESG, MSCI USA Leaders ETF, SUSL, and Xtrackers MSCI USA ESG Leaders Family ETF, USSG. those both do not have Facebook in it, but in their top holdings, you'll see a lot of tech companies. In fact, Microsoft's at the top of both of them. Alphabet, which is the Google parent, is up there as well, as is Apple. But so their absence speaks volumes in the ESG circles, in my opinion.
Drew, this is Jason. Facebook's a great example of an issue. As an advisor, I have a hard time explaining, and I think investors have a hard time understanding when it comes to the ESG space. Because if there's three boxes, it may be easy to check one as a company. It's a little harder to check two. It's very difficult for a company to check all three boxes. There's just no perfect company. I mean, isn't that really the way it is?
Well, that's where the rankings come in, too. So you can kind of get a feel for how high up the totem pole a particular fund is in trying to achieve these goals. Off the top of my head, I think we have two funds that two ETFs. One is, I believe, the Denmark fund and the Netherlands fund. But these are funds, these are ETFs made up of companies in those countries. And those countries are known for ESG as being part of the culture, not part of an FTC agreement. So, yes, it is very hard to do that. But if you get two out of three and maybe the third, your ranking will be much higher than some ESG funds that have triple Bs that just frankly are sort of large cap funds with a theme as opposed to really being ESG.
Well, Drew, we're going to have to leave it there. Always appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you, guys.
That was Drew Voros, ETF.com's editor-in-chief. All right, our next guest is Ryan Kerlin, head of capital markets at Alpha Architect, who currently offers six ETFs with about $400 million invested. These primarily focus on value and momentum. But Ryan has a unique background in the ETF business. He was previously part of the ETF group at the New York Stock Exchange, where he helped launch over 600 ETFs. He was also head of capital markets at Revenue Shares. And I've got to tell you, Ryan is not one to shy away from expressing his views on everything from smart beta to ESG investing, which of course is our focus this week. Ryan is now on the line with us from Philadelphia. Ryan, great having you back. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, fellas.
All right, so last you were on ETF Prime, you were trying to kill the term smart beta, which unfortunately, I think despite your best efforts, you haven't quite succeeded yet. It might even be getting stronger. Are you still waging that battle?
Yeah, totally. It's still meaningless.
All right, so look, I know one of your biggest issues with smart beta is that you think it's simply a marketing term, right? It doesn't help investors understand what an ETF actually does. You believe ETF providers should just explain the investment process behind an ETF instead of hiding behind a catch-all term. And my sense is you have similar views around ESG ETFs. So you actually tweeted out, quote, ESG is meaningless. And on that note, I want to play a couple of clips for you. So these are from SEC Commissioner Hester Pierce. She delivered a speech at an event hosted by the American Enterprise Institute. And I would say she completely eviscerated ESG in the speech. For our listeners, stick with us. Hester does have a bit of a monotone delivery, but try to pay attention to what she's saying because she really is breathing fire here.
We're seeing a similar phenomenon in today's modern but no less flawed world. In these remarks, I'll focus specifically on the way in which corporations are being assessed according to environmental, social, and governance, or ESG factors. Here, too, we see labeling based on incomplete information, public shaming and shunning wrapped in moral rhetoric, preached with cold-hearted, self-righteous oblivion to the consequences which ultimately fall on real people. In our purportedly enlightened era, we pin scarlet letters on allegedly offending corporations without bothering much about the facts and circumstances, and seemingly without caring about the unwarranted harm that such labeling can engender. After all, naming and shaming corporate villains is fun, trendy, and profitable.
All right, so that was the beginning of the speech. Let me play the end here.
People are free to invest their money as they wish, but they can only do so if the peddlers of ESG products and philosophies are honest about the limitations of those products and philosophies. The collection of issues that gets dropped into the ESG bucket is diverse, but many of them simply cannot be reduced to a simple, single standardizable score. As beautifully simple as it is, a stark letter A does not always serve to convey the truth. The moral authorities of today, like their puritanical forebears, are motivated by a dream of a better society. But methods matter, and so do facts. We ought to be wary of shrill cries from a crowd of self-appointed, self-righteous authorities, even when all they're crying for is a label. Thank you.
All right, Ryan, so there is a lot here. This was a lengthy speech. I just pulled a small snippet of her comments, but I want to focus on something she said towards the end, which is, quote, people are free to invest their money as they wish, but they can only do so if the peddlers of ESG products and philosophies are honest about the limitations of those products. And, you know, that brought me back to your take on smart beta. So let's start there. Is that ultimately your concern, that ESG is being sold as something more than what it really is? It's more marketing than substance?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, pretty much right. And I'm so happy she wrote that. She's clearly much smarter than I am, can articulate the idea and the issue much better than I could. But it's that marketing is not a dirty word. You're marketing here by having this radio show. I'm marketing by being on here. Hopefully we're educating the people that are listening a little bit. That the problem is, and what she hits on, she said, the peddlers of ESG need to be honest. The problem is the lack of transparency. That's my problem with Smart Beta. That's my problem with ESG. My friends and I, we laugh. We sit around when we're at the bar and we're watching, you know, LeBron James, and it's the fourth quarter, and there's, you know, they're down by 2 points, right? And he pulls up for a three and he misses, and the whole bar erupts, right? And everybody in there starts going nuts. Oh, I would have driven to the lane and gotten 2 points, right? And my buddies and I, we laugh. We go, yeah, there's a lot of coaches in here, you know, really a lot of coaches. You got those players on the court are making millions of dollars. The coaches are the best in the world. They're making millions of dollars. But Joe Beercan over there, you know, knows what they should have done. You can't make it up. And that's many of these ESG experts or peddlers, as Hester called them, with companies, you know, telling the CEOs and the boards what they should have done based off of whatever the trendy news of the day is. You know, but what do they really know?
From a company's perspective, do you think it even matters if investors stop buying stocks of companies they disagree with? Right? Because these shares are all trading in the secondary market. The companies have already raised the capital. So if you're selling shares or not buying them, somebody else is. So does it really matter from a company's perspective?
It doesn't matter yet. I mean, I guess I could say this would actually be a better debate. You know, everybody likes to rage against the active versus passive debate, and I don't really see long-term issues there. This you know, in a long-term scenario, again, say if we just became totally insane and the S&P 500 became ESG, that could cause real ramifications in the market. Not that we're anywhere near that, but that would be the problem. Does it really matter, though, to your point? Cliff Asness wrote a whole paper on ESG himself. And the point of his paper is just do the simple math, right? And let's make it super simple. So say I cloned Warren Buffett. He's the greatest stock picker of all time. And I said, you know, hey, he's going to live forever, this clone and Warren Buffett. And they got 100 years. And I gave Warren A 1,000 stocks to choose from. I gave Warren's exact clone 200 stocks to choose from every year for 100 years. Now, you need to bet. Warren Buffett A has 1,000 stocks to choose from. Warren Buffett B has 200 stocks to choose from, right, every year. Who's going to select the better stocks over the long term?
Well, you know, Ryan, as I try to think about all aspects of this ESG debate, one of the things I keep coming back to is that I feel like the financial markets ultimately decide which companies are doing the right things according to society standards. Mm-hmm. So if companies are engaging in practices that rankle the masses, that's going to be a problem for them because people will stop buying their products and services. They'll boycott the companies. They'll blow them up on social media. And I think that will ultimately be reflected in their stock prices, which I think is what you're driving at. So, you know, I like to think of the financial markets as the ultimate ESG arbiter. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let the market decide. You know, not some ESG expert as Hester Pearson.
You know, I saw Colin Roach, founder of Orcam Group. So he recently tweeted out something that got a ton of response. Not all good. He said, "Quote: I once had a client who refused to own gun companies. I said, who would you rather have earning the profits from these firms? Someone who will pour the money back into that cause or someone who will redistribute it to a cause you believe in? He owns all the gun companies now." And so his point is the gun companies are making money and you can either take those profits and redistribute them to causes you believe in, or you can let somebody else take those profits and potentially invest them into things you don't believe in. Do you think that's a better way to think about making an impact?
Yeah, you know, and I think in the ESG world, there is, you know, kind of two ways you can make an impact. You can either say, hey, I'm not going to own the stock and then somebody else is making the profits, or you can own the stock and try to make changes from within, too. So, I mean, that's another avenue. But yeah, you know, go make money and then you're going to be able to change the world in a much bigger way if you have more money to do so.
Obviously, there are investors who do have very strong beliefs around various societal issues. So how do you think they should approach these? Because if, let's say I'm highly against gun companies, I may just have a hard time owning these in my index fund. So isn't there some rationale for ESG here? You know, what if it just makes me sick to my stomach to own gun stocks?
Yeah. For smaller, or not even smaller, it could be huge institutions, but that's kind of the point. ESG is so unique to each individual. And that's kind of the problem at the mass ETF scale level. But yeah, if you're an institution, you want to run a separately managed account, or if you're an individual and you're like, you know, for religious purposes, I can't own liquor companies or whatever. Yeah, that's great.
What about direct indexing? So there's been talks that maybe that could be a good solution for ESG, right? If people want to exclude gun companies or whatever, they would easily be able to do so. Do you think that could be a good longer term solution?
Yeah, I talked to Dave Nadig about that, and he had me come around on that some, that direct indexing can be a great solution, and that's exactly where direct indexing can be. Not as bullish as some people are on direct indexing. You know, some people have even hinted direct indexing is going to be the disruptor of ETFs as ETFs disrupted mutual funds. I would not go that far, but there's direct indexing could certainly help provide for individuals.
No, I completely agree. I do think it would be a good solution. I still get back to the fact that that's ultimately active investing, which isn't inherently good or bad, but people who begin to exclude different companies, they have to realize that they may start taking on some tracking error. It is active. And, you know, hopefully that doesn't get lost in the discussion. Ryan, I'll close our ESG discussion with this. So we had Nuveen's head of ETF product development, Jordan Ferris, on the show back in June. And Nuveen is obviously heavily involved in the ESG space. But I actually thought he had a really balanced answer to this question of how people should think about ESG. Take a listen.
There are three ways that you can sort of affect change. You can do it by donating money, by giving to charity. You can do it by protesting, or you can do it by investing, or you can do all three. The investment, if you want to maintain diversification and you want to have exposure to large cap, mid cap, small cap, core fixed income, things like that, there is a balance between how much increase in ESG you have and what the risk return profile you're going to get is going to be. If you have something that you're very passionate about, maybe it makes more sense to give to a charity in that area or go protest or direct your buying decisions. But for investments, it may make sense to balance those two things. What do I want in terms of ESG improvement? What do I want in terms of my risk return profile?
And, you know, I think those comments get back to what I was just talking about with direct indexing, right? That ultimately, you may have some active tracking error if you're investing ESG. But Jordan mentioned you can donate money, you can protest, you can reflect your social views through your investments. I just think it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out longer term. Any thoughts on what ESG ETFs might look like down the road, just in terms of the growth trajectory?
Just to get to that, back to that comment, though, They're telling you that you can do good and make higher returns. That's the problem, because the basic math tells us that can't be true. That's what I was getting at with the Warren Buffett example. You can't give a constrained universe and then expect to do better than somebody that has an unconstrained universe over the long term, right? So if you want to be if somebody who's selling ESG is telling me, hey, we're martyrs, right? We're gonna withstand pain. We're gonna take suffering. We're gonna have lower returns because we're fighting for a cause that we believe in. That's great. I respect that person. You got skin in the game. We're gonna suffer. Like, let's go. Great, right? But you can't tell me, which like some people do. I'm not saying Jordan did, but other people have definitely said, right? Hey, we're gonna give you higher returns and you're gonna do good. That is what I have a problem with. And over the long term, what do I think the ESG space is going to be? I have a longstanding bet with a couple of people from financial Twitter. I believe it'll be less than 1.5% of the ETF U.S. ETF market over the long term.
I think I saw that, and I think I agree with you on the under there. All right, so let's quickly move on and get to our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. I only have a handful of questions here. We'll have to go quick. So first, we'll put this ESG thing to bed. Which term causes you more grief, ESG or smart beta?
Oh, wow. I guess at this point, ESG, just because there was a term where, you know, there was a time where smart beta was a good term. I'll go with ESG.
All right. What's an ETF you would like to see Alpha Architect launch, but you can't talk Wes Gray, your CEO, into supporting?
We got a couple of things on the drawing board, so I don't know what I can say there.
Is there anything that he's actually just shot down altogether?
I don't think so. I mean, we kind of think similarly in that there's structural advantages to ETFs, so you want to build things that take advantage of structural ETFs. Don't do anything closet indexing that you'll never see Alpha Architect come out with, or at least for the long, long future. Yeah, I don't have a good answer there.
All right, is value investing dead?
Negative. Obviously, I got to say that, but do genuinely believe it. It's like anything. Value. This is what I'm getting at with the ESG thing, right? If they said, "Hey, there's going to be pain and suffering. We're going to underperform, therefore we're going to be martyrs." Great. Now you're selling me as an ESG guy. And with value at Alpha Architect, we say the same thing. Like, hopefully over the long term you outperform, but in order to outperform, there has to be pain and suffering. Because if there wasn't pain and suffering, everybody would do it. So value's not dead. There's just pain and suffering that has to come with it, and that's what we're going through now.
That is a perfect lead into my next question, which is, what's more painful, trend following or the march for the fallen?
Trend following for sure. Yeah. Trend following is just different, and it's incredibly painful to be different for a very, very long time. You know, trend following, Jack Bogle, our CIO, did a study where he showed you, if you were trend following, I believe it was the S&P 500, you would have underperformed over a 26-year period by 3% annualized leading up to 1999. So the time, it's like Chinese water torture. It's just time of suffering is much worse than a one-day suffering, which is what the March for the Fallen is. Give me that. Give me one day of suffering any day versus, you know, a decade.
About a minute left with March for the Fallen. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about that event? I know Alpha Architect is a huge supporter of this. It's coming up in September. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it takes place in the middle of Pennsylvania. It's a living memorial, I guess you would say, for Gold Star families and those who were killed in action. The point is not to raise money. At Alpha Architect, I know we set it up where you can join us for $35 and you get sleeping and food and everything paid for. So it's not a financial event. It's a physical memorial for Gold Star families and members killed in action.
Is there a website people can go to if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, you just go to alphaarchitect.com. That's our website, and then /MFTF for March for the Fallen.
Well, Ryan, great stuff this week. I really appreciate your willingness to dive into the ESG debate. Obviously, there's a lot of passion on both sides of that, so certainly appreciate your perspective. Thanks for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me, guys.
That was Ryan Kerlin, head of capital markets at Alpha Architect. Let's go right to our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
The ETF we're spotlighting this week is the Validia Market Legends ETF, ticker VALX. And joining us via phone from New York to discuss this ETF is John Reese, co-founder and CEO of Validia Capital Management. He's also author of the book, The Guru Investor, How to Beat the Market Using History's Best Investment Strategies. John, great having you back on the show.
Nate, thanks for having me back.
John, so this is a unique ETF. Basically, you're attempting to replicate the stock selection strategies of some of the greatest investors of all time, Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch. Let's start with the basics. How are you going about doing this? How do you replicate an investor like Warren Buffett?
Well, first of all, this started many decades ago when I was looking to invest my own money in the stock market and was reading a wide variety of books by legendary investors. When I actually came across the book One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch, where all of a sudden it struck me that who is not only somebody that actually had a reputation and a track record, but had gone through and in a book described in detail his stock selection process. And furthermore, it was detailed enough that you could actually follow it, and I felt that I could implement it with a computer program. A lot of books and experts out there talk in terms of vague generalities. They may say that you want to get a company that has great management. Well, what exactly is that? How do you know when the company has great management? So you have to look for expressions that each of the experts basically say can be translated into a usually quantitative rule. So with Warren Buffett, that was particularly interesting because he is almost the one person who did not write his own book on investing. He's written a number of investor letters, but much of the wisdom of how he's gone about investing has been shared in other books that have been written about him. I've read almost all of them, and I found the best book on that to be Buffettology by his ex-daughter-in-law, Mary Buffett. So reading through those books, reading through her books and workbooks, and extracting the formulas, and then in each case, usually there are very clear examples that the author has presented about particular stock selections. And I go through that in intense detail, examining the rules, seeing is that consistent with what the expert has actually said. And when you look at patterns, you're able to judge what are the maximums, what are the minimums that they've generally gone for. You're able to extract rules. So I'll generally read a book about five times to extract the wisdom and turn them into computer rules is how I go about that. And then over time, over the years, you will see articles published where there's some clarification, some journalist is able to get or extract some additional bit of wisdom, or the person actually has a newsletter. And when that comes up, if that translates or refines a rule, I will then adapt that rule to it. So that's how I go about that process.
And John, how many guru investors have you replicated this process for?
Well, I originally started with 12, and today I'm up to now 45 different guru strategies.
So I guess on that note, I mean, you mentioned reading the book on Warren Buffett five times. How much time and research has gone into developing these models over the years? It seems like a tremendous amount of research work.
It really has. I'm not sure if I have an actual average. I became more efficient as I did more models, but I would say maybe a couple of months just in terms of doing the reading and rereading and extracting some of the formulas on paper, and then another couple of months to actually code it up and handle, you know, various conditions. When you're looking at just one stock at a time, that in some ways that's easy. When all of a sudden you now feed in 3,500 or 6,000 different stocks, you find all sorts of different parameters and combinations that the guru may not have individually addressed, but you have to find the wisdom in their teachings in order to handle all of the different stock combinations.
John, this is Jason Lank. You're with 49 different guru models. I'm sure there must be something for every investor under the sun there. Just from a high level, do you tend to see a concentration of ideas in a lot of the strategies, or is just everybody spread out far and thin?
Well, actually, you ask a very good question. Overall, the basic addition is there is a very wide spread between what the strategies select. They're, for the most part, they're selecting different stocks. That said, we do find and look for combinations where one or sometimes several gurus also like the stock at the same time. And when we have a tie in selecting a portfolio, we base that tie on how many of the gurus are also recommending that stock at the same time. A second aspect of answering that question is that over long periods of time, the gurus tend to like certain, usually very unpopular, undervalued industries. At one point in time, it was the steel industry. Another point in time, it was the retail industry. Usually, it's extremely unpopular with the experts in the field saying that this industry has no growth in it as far as the eye can possibly see. You definitely don't want to be in there. And that excites a lot of these strategies at the same time. They're starting to say it's when the expectations are low, the value is there, and you will start at those times to see clusters in particular industries. Many times those works out. Not all the times, but many times those when they focus in on particular industries, it works great.
John, so tell us more about the ETF itself, the Validia Market Legends ETF. Again, ticker symbol VALX. How exactly is this operating?
The VALX basically has between 5 to 10 of the guru strategies, each selecting a sleeve of 10 of its best picks for the stocks on a monthly basis. So each strategy will pick stocks on a monthly basis, and the highest rated ones will be picked in. Each stock is rated on a score of 0 to 100. by a particular guru based upon those criteria that I had mentioned before. Stocks are screened out for liquidity, so there's about 2,500 right now in the market that are currently eligible, liquid enough for trading. And right now we have 9 of the models selecting, therefore, 90 stocks. Again, each sleeve according to one of the guru strategies.
And so can you add new models over time, or will you always be at 9? Can you go more or less?
No, but at the end of each year, the index committee reviews all the models, and at that point in time, we take into consideration the long-term performance of the model, how it correlates with the other models, and the factor exposures of the models, such as the exposure to value. And from there, the models and the ETF are selected based upon the expected future returns and mean reversion. So small changes are made infrequently in terms of you're adding or, if necessary, subtracting a model or replacing it with another model.
Did I see correctly that this ETF utilizes stop losses on individual positions? Is that right?
Yes, we do. We use wide stop losses. We use what we call a dynamic stop loss. So we don't just fix it at a particular level. When I say wide, it starts at 40%. But to that, we add the either increase or decline of the S&P 500, 50% of that increase or 50% of decline. So if the market is moving down very substantially, we adjust the stop loss actually down. We don't let general market movements stop us out. It usually has to be something because of the individual stock that will generate that 40% or more stop loss, or less if the S&P 500 has gone up since that stock has been acquired.
John, if you don't mind, I would like to ask you about performance. I know it's been a tough year for this ETF relative to the S&P 500, and really that's been the case going back to the ETF's inception. And you talked earlier about how this ETF gets exposure. What's driving that? Like, is this ultimately tied to something like values underperformance?
Yes. Basically, of the guru models, it turns out that 70% of the models are highly related to value. Value, in our research, has had the best long-term performance, over the years, whether you look back 50 years or 100 years in the market. But there are periods of time, since 1945, there have been 6 periods of time where value has dramatically underperformed growth, as we've seen right now for the last several years. In fact, since the great financial crisis in 2008, value has been substantially underperforming growth. This is not something that hasn't seen before. It has, but nevertheless, we don't know when it ends. When it does end, each of those 6 episodes that I've just mentioned has shown tremendous 50, 60, 70, 100% performance of value, then outperforming growth when that actually occurs. We just don't know what the timing is.
And I think this tacks on to Jason's question earlier, but it sounds like you don't have any concerns with quote unquote over-allocating to a particular factor. If your models spit out value, if that seems dominant across the models, that's what you're going to allocate to. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. We, again, have found the best success over time letting the models go where they want to. Our ETF is unusual in that it is an all-cap fund. The models are able to pick between small, medium, large cap. It's able to pick between the U.S. And internationally. And as the factors see fit, as they find more value opportunities, they will go more into value. It's based upon mean reversion. We still feel that mean reversion permeates the entire market and is there. You can't necessarily predict when the reversion actually occurs, but we can still be highly confident that it will occur.
And John, where do you see the ETF fitting in an investment portfolio?
I basically see it as a VALX would be inappropriate as a 10 to 15% allocation in someone's portfolio for a long-term investor that's looking to allocate to a fund that seeks market outperformance but looks nothing like the market. It looks nothing like the S&P 500. And right now has very high exposure to value stocks, small caps, international stocks, all of which have been directly out of favor at the current time. So it's really a long-term bet that those are going to come back in favor and be highly rewarding.
Is, I think, about all of the research you've done on these individual guru models, have you ever considered launching an ETF based on a single model? So, you know, something like a Warren Buffett ETF?
So, yes, actually we have, and that's a very interesting, intriguing idea. One of the key reasons, of course, we've considered doing that is there is individual investor interest in particular legendary investors and models. Offsetting that has been the fact that we also have a belief that all models, including the individual experts, come in and out of favor over time, and that we wanted to blend strategies together in one model so that one goes out of favor, another one basically comes in favor. It's an easier ride to follow. One of the problems in investing overall for most individuals is that funds can come in and out of favor and go through extremes, and it's very difficult to stay through the down periods and stay around for the rewarding periods. So we had thought the best answer to that was to offer funds together, even though we recognize that there is quite a lot of interest in individual gurus.
Well, John, really interesting spotlight this week. Glad we could reconnect. Thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
That was John Rees, co-founder and CEO of Validia Capital Management. And you can learn more about the Validia Market Legends ETF by visiting validiafunds.com. That's V-A-L-I-D-E-A funds.com. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, we'll have a very special cannabis-infused edition of ETF Prime. I promise you're not going to want to miss this. We're going to go in-depth on what I think is one of the biggest ETF stories this year, marijuana ETF. So certainly hope you'll join us for that. Until then, have a great week, everyone.